That's it for us from today.
Yeah, Let's Talk is coming up next.
We'll see you tomorrow.
98.9 FM News.
This is Cassandra Tim with the National Indigenous News. The federal government has confirmed Australia will respond to the Ebola crisis in West Africa by contracting a private organisation to assist in the operation of a treatment centre in Sierra Leone. Pressure has been put on the government to help treat the virus in hotspots in the region. It'll provide $20 million to help run a 100-bed treatment centre. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says it's likely about 240 staff will be engaged in the operation.
This will be a centre that's being built by the United Kingdom, but it will be staffed by Australia through a medical provider, Aspen, an Australian provider. Most of the staff will be locally engaged. There will be some international staff, and some of those are likely to include Australian paid volunteers.
Former Prime Minister Gough Coolum-Whitlam has been described as a brave and inspiring man whose memory will live on. Redfern elder Arnie Millie Ingram welcomed thousands of people who gathered on Gadigal Country in Sydney for the state memorial service. Among them were members of the Gurindji clan from the Daguragu south of Darwin, whose descendants led the struggle for land rights in the 1960s. Mr. Whitlam's eldest son Anthony paid tribute to his father's legacy as well as the Gurindji people.
The road to reconciliation and recognition started with the Whitlam government, but its land rights proposals were in substance implemented by Malcolm Fraser's government. The attendance of representatives from the Gurindji people is a truly humbling testament to Gough's legacy. The road ahead may be tortuous and difficult for all Australians, but we need not be divided on partisan lines.
The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council says it's now looking to move on in its dealings with the state government after the withdrawal of the controversial Crown Lands Amendment Bill. The bill aimed to extinguish almost 2,000 Aboriginal land claims, some dating back as far as two decades, but has been withdrawn by the government in the immediate future. Wiradjuri and Ngambo man Craig Cromlin is chair of NSWALC. He says our mob in New South Wales will be moving forward with precaution.
We've got to get on with business. It just means now that they need to work hard to gain some faith back from us. So I think the way that this was done has lost a lot of respect, a lot of ground that was made over a number of years, and it was undone because of a silly bill that was introduced that need not have happened, certainly not without consulting the network, the local Aboriginal land councils up and down the eastern seaboard that have access to beachfronts, and they failed to contact the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. I could say it's not forgotten. The process that was undertaken here is not forgotten, and it's going to take some work to, I guess, build back a healthy respect for one another. But for the sake of the network, for the sake of our Aboriginal brothers and sisters that are in New South Wales, we need to get on with business, and that's what we'll be doing. But we'll be doing so with a fair amount of caution.
We'll have sport and weather straight after this.
There are 44,485 Australians in the Army, leading, teaching, inspiring and creating, making a difference and leaving their mark. They're officers, soldiers, in full-time and part-time positions, for a year, for a lifetime, and everything in between in just about any job you could imagine. They're changing the future, serving our country, making us better, and the Army needs more just like you. To find out more, search Army Jobs or call 131901. Army, challenge yourself.
Program sponsor.
Sport now with Sean Bindley.
Ex-Kangaroos forward Rennie Matua has been named in the Samoan side to meet Australia in the crucial Four Nations clash in Wollongong on Sunday. Without a win in the tournament so far, a win to Samoa by greater than 10 points and a New Zealand victory over England could see Samoa into the final. Australia are expecting a fired-up Samoan side to put the dramas of the past fortnight behind them, and trainer and ex-Kangaroo Craig Fitzgibbon expects the Samoans to provide a real contest for the injury-hit Aussies.
I guess, yeah, a team, they've got nothing to lose, so that makes them dangerous, unpredictable, and some star individual players in their team that are really tough to contain.
And that's the latest in news and sport. Now for a look at the latest capital city weather. Partly partly cloudy is the forecast for Sydney with a high of 23 degrees. Mostly sunny in Melbourne with a high of 23. A shower or two and a possible storm in Brisbane with a high of 29 degrees. Late shower or two in Perth with a high of 23. Partly cloudy in Adelaide with a high of 29 degrees. Partly cloudy in Hobart with a high of 19. Cloud decreasing in Canberra with a high of 24. Showers and a likely storm in Darwin with a high of 32 degrees. And that's the latest national Indigenous news.
Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales with Let's Talk.
Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to you. To each and every one of you, it's great to have your company. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, my guest today is the chairperson of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, Mr. Craig Cromlin, talking to me via telephone from Sydney, I think. I'll take a guess. I could be wrong. Craig, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you very much, Tiger. Glad to join you this morning. Actually, I'm actually calling you from my home, which is Murrum Bridge.
All right.
I managed to find the highest point on the property of Murrum Bridge, which is about 1,000 acres. And so I've got the best coverage, so I can give you a call on my mobile.
Very good. We certainly appreciate it. Now, tell us your mob, your country, and then I'll ask you to tell us where's Murrum Bridge. But tell us your mob. Where's your mob and where your country is?
Okay. I have, I guess, I've always grown up around and always accepted the my nan's side, which is the Nyampa side. I've always been more exposed to my aunties and uncles teaching me and you know, everyone, younger fellow in the community about Nyampa language. My grandfather is a Wiradjuri man, and I love him dearly, so I accept both my Nyampa and Wiradjuri heritage. And then on the Cromlin side comes from my father, who married my mother here in Murrum Bridge. Back in the 60s, he came from up around the Grafton area, and I have a lot of mob up in on that Grafton, Coffs Harbour region up there. So hello to the mob up there.
All right, Nyampa mob.
Nyampa mob. Just to tell you, Murrum Bridge is one of those resettlement communities that were built back in the 1940s. My mum was 8 years of age when this community was opened up, when she was brought here from Menindee Mission, where she was born on the banks of the Darling River. And all the mob that, and a fair few of them being Nyampa people, which were, a lot of them were my nan's siblings, and other people came to here to Murrum Bridge. I think back in them days there would have been upwards of about 500 people that were living in the community, and so it was made up of people from Wiradjuri descent, Nyampa descent, and Barkindji.
All right.
So it was a nice mixture. Murrum Bridge is actually in the boundary of the Wiradjuri nation, but it was all of these three mixtures of tribal people that made up the community of Murrum Bridge. So a lot of people have connections to it from those particular tribes, Nyampa, Barkindji, and Wiradjuri.
What are some of the towns you might be able to name for the benefit of listeners that might know, that give them an idea of where Nyampa country is?
Right, Nyampa country is I guess Cobar is one of them, but it's Ivanhoe is certainly a part of it. My nan's people were part of an area which was called Carrara Tank, and it was from those, and Carrara Tank being one of those government tanks that were there for water, access for farmers and et cetera. And people were round up from that Crowra Tank area. There were other areas around there where other mob were from, and that was all part of that Nyampa area. They were taken from there and moved to the Menindee Mission. There were also people from Pooncarie and White Cliffs and apparently Tipperborough, what my mum was telling me, that were all moved and taken to that mission and put there at the old mission, which is still, I think it's in the ownership of the Menindee Local Aboriginal Land Council these days. And from there, once they opened up Murrum Bridge, people had the opportunity to come this way. Some stayed. I don't know what was the rationale behind who stayed and who went, whether you had the choice to go or whether you were just forced to go back in them days. But the people ended up here. Mm-hmm. So Cobar's pretty much the boundary. Ivanhoe, and then it goes out even towards, I think, towards Ningen area. I'm not quite sure.
Okay, yeah.
And then above there's the Nyima group, which is, we speak similar dialect.
Yeah, right.
And we're part of the bigger tribe, which is the Wongabon people.
Yes, yes. All right. And where did you actually grow up then, as a young fella?
Here at Murrum Bridge. I was born in at Lake Angelica, which is about 15 kilometres away. We're right on the banks of the Lachlan River, so it runs there. I mean, we spent a lot of our childhood down at the river, either fishing or swimming, depending on what the season was. So I grew up here. My mum, when we lost our dad, he got killed in 66 along with two other guys. It was a tragic accident. Three of them got killed at the one time. My mum decided in 71 to take us to West Wyalong to live. We stayed there for 2 years, but we pestered mum to bring us kids back to Lake Murrum Bridge. We always wanted to come back home. And when she came back home, she bought a house in at Lake Angelica, and we lived there pretty much I came back when I entered school in fourth class. And then I stayed there till I went halfway through year 11. And then once I left school, I came straight out to Murrum Bridge and pretty much been here all my life.
All right. All right. Now, the New South Wales Land Rights Act, you're the chairperson of New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. It's a three-tiered structure the under the Land Rights Act. You've got local land councils, you've got regional councils, and you've got the New South Wales Land Council. Is that correct?
Tiger, it used to be a three-tiered structure, but what's happened in there were amendments to the Act in, I think it was 2005, which came into effect around 2006, certainly in 2007, where the regions were no longer.
Okay.
So we went from 13 regions to 9, and we just have New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council and the and the 120 now it is, 120 local Aboriginal Land Councils.
Okay. And only the one statutory body being NSWALC.
The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, yes.
It's the only statutory body where all those local land councils and 13 regions were all statutory bodies in the early days of establishing.
Each of those Aboriginal land councils are their own autonomous bodies on their own. And our connection to those is, I guess, through the funding arrangements that we have, but they've got their own powers to make decisions as and when they feel fit.
And NSWALC is there to support and guide along the way.
Well, yeah. We have a dual role, which at sometimes it clashes with ourselves. We're there to advocate and do things on their behalf, but we're also there as a regulatory responsibility, and that creates, I guess, some tensions at times. But how we manage that is done without creating too much friction between the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council and the local Aboriginal Land Councils. I mean, we ourselves come from, represent a local Aboriginal Land Council, mine being the Murrumbidgee Local Aboriginal Land Council, and the other eight councillors also are a member of their local Aboriginal Land Council, a voting member for that.
Mm. So. Mm. How is it, the operational aspect of things with no regional councils now, just local and News Welk? How's that working? It worked out. It's been going for a few years.
It's been an operation. I mean, there are, I guess, there'll be, fors and against with all of it. There'll be those that, from that old era, that say, no, we should still have the regions available. I guess I didn't have a great deal of involvement with the regions as such. I got involved and I became chairperson of the Murrumbidgee Local Aboriginal Land Council in the late 80s, early 90s. And we really only operated within our own boundaries, and we thought our world didn't go beyond our boundaries until we branched out. You know, and got to network through the regions and other local Aboriginal land councils. But there'll be arguments one way or the other, Tiger, about what is the best structure. But, I mean, we have what we have now, and we're trying to do the absolute best with what we've got.
Yes.
And I'm not, certainly no expert on what the regions delivered. I mean, they've done some really good things back in those days, and there might be others that might have a differing of an opinion.
Yeah.
I'm certainly no expert on the other. I only know what we have now. It seems to be working. I mean, like anything else, we can always work to improve on it, I guess.
Of course. Now, a couple of the key elements of this New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act, which was enacted in 83, I believe. That
correct.
A couple of the key aspects are, one, you no longer draw on government funds. Is that correct? You're self-funded, due to your interest funds were generated over the first 15 years, and then the interest comes off that.
Yeah, well, it was in 98 when they put a sunset clause on that.
Yep.
Stopped the, because the money used to come from land tax in New South Wales, and there's a lot of debate today that that tap shouldn't have even been turned off. It should actually be turned back on.
That's right.
Stay. But what it meant that at that particular point in time, there was an amount of money that was in the bank, and that's what we've had to do to this point today, and even at that particular point in 98, those particular councillors had to operate within the confines that they had, which was around about, I think, $480 million at the time.
That was the amount that was invested.
They've done a terrific job with putting structures in place, processes in place, policies in place to ensure that they grow the fund.
Yeah. That $480 million, that was the accumulated investments over that first 15 years?
Yeah.
And the network now operates on the interest generated by that 480, is that correct?
Yes, basically. We just operate on the interest that comes out of it. Mm. That's our responsibility, as it was with those particular councillors back in 98 and even earlier than that, it's our responsibility to make sure that we protect that fund, we grow that fund, and we look at all possibilities and options that are available to us. But you're correct in saying, Tiger, that it doesn't draw on any resources, no taxpayer funds whatsoever. That's not to say that we can't go out and apply for government programs or systems like that. But all the dollars, and it's about $16 million annually that we draw down to provide annual budgets to the local Aboriginal Land Council, plus what it costs to run News Welk at the same time. So all of those dollars don't draw on any taxpayers' funders. It's money that's been invested and strategically managed in-house, either by a fund manager or an investment organisation to help grow our fund for today's generation, but looking further down the track for the future generations, the Burrais Welling, as we might be saying.
you always need more money. There's never enough money. Be you a community-controlled organisation like a legal service, a health service, or a media association like we have here, you always need more money. How can Newswealth grow that fund so that just it's generating more interest? Is there are there opportunities or possibilities for Newswealth to actually grow the amount that's invested?
Well, that's a great segue into the, I guess, the next point, Tiger. And look, before I say this, can I say for myself personally, every time I get to meet former councillors that have been with the organisation that is New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, that have worked within it, that helped to pave the pathway for fellows like me, and I'll be 50 this year, so I consider myself a young fella. I'm still very much learning. But when I talk to people, and I'm referring directly to you, I am so absolutely humbled and honoured to actually have the opportunity to yarn to you. So I'm sitting over this side of the microphone, and I'm chuffed to be speaking to someone such as yourself, because I remember seeing you as a young fella, you know, at the forefront in a lot of the rallies and taking up the fight for the mob in those days. So I feel very honoured to be actually having the opportunity for you to interview me, and I think I'd have, I'm really pleased. But I just wanted to say that before the opportunity or this interview concludes for today.
Thank you very much. But it certainly was a great learning time for me. Because your capacity as chairperson, you're the highest elected First Nations person in the state, and I think that's got to be recognised where people actually vote for you to be chair, and it doesn't happen in Queensland, or I don't think it happens in Victoria or South Australia, where there's a statewide body where First Nations people within that state have the opportunity to elect their own head of the land rights legislation, or the Land Rights Act, for the administration of that act. So it's it was a great opportunity for me. Great learning curve and stuff.
And it is very much like that for me. And so I'm absolutely honoured and thrilled to. I remember seeing a quote the other day, and I'll come back to your question about where do we get more resources from the other day. I came across a quote of which I used at the funeral of the late Maurie Keane, someone who you would have been very familiar with,
yes,
Tiger,
that's right.
Been instrumental in getting the Land Rights Act up and into Parliament and enacted upon. But I used a quote that I saw from Warren Buffett, and the quote was, "I stand in the shade today because someone a long time ago planted a seed."
Yeah, it's a great one, isn't it?
Even though you may not have actually planted the seed, you were certainly there watering and nurturing that tree to grow so that my generation and generations be, well after I have moved on from the land rights movement, will be able to also stand in the shade of that tree because someone planted it. But I wanted to just say that, Nick, I'll go back to your question. How do we get more dollars? I guess at present what we do with the resources of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, we invest in mainly blue chip investment. So we've got someone that gives us a lot of advice and good strategic advice on where to place our money to get a good return for our dollars. I guess it's about managing risk whenever we're doing it. And we've got structures in place to make sure that the advice that we got is the absolute best advice that we can get anyway. But we looked at, and I'm talking, I've been a councillor now since 2007 when council came out of administration. And they had elections in 2007. The regions had changed from 13 down to 9. Each region, each local Aboriginal Land Council, for those that were voting members, were able to go out and contest elections. Anyone who was a voting member was able to stand for the elections, and then it was a matter of once you've put your name in, you were accepted on the ballot paper, you went to the election on a particular date that was nominated by the council at the time, and if you were the highest, the person with the highest number, you was actually then elected as a councillor. Once the nine were elected, they then sat down to elect their chair and their deputy. So it's the regions actually pick, go to election to select or to elect their councillor. Once you're elected as a councillor, it's then up to the councillor to elect the chair and the deputy. So that's how I managed to be. But I was elected in 2007. Humbly re-elected in 2011, and we go to elections again in 2015. So every 4 years there's an election, of which voting members of the local Aboriginal Land Council can go out and elect someone from their region to sit on to this particular organisation, which is the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. So in relation to the mining... The other things that we've looked at, we said, well, there is at the time there was the mining boom. There were resources in this country that everyone else seems to have a benefit of, and most of them are companies from overseas that were getting the benefits of the resources in this country. Now, mining, whenever you mention mining, creates a fair bit of discussion and thought and challenges the very nature of who we are as Aboriginal people, you know, people to care and nurture our land and look after it for the next generations. But there's always in the back of your mind, you mentioned, where do we get the dollars from? And if we just sat there and relied purely on the investments, I mean, in 2009, 2010, we had the GFC, or the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. We were severely affected by that. And it we lost a significant amount of money. I mean, but it didn't shut our doors. But it meant that we had to relook at how we distribute our dollars, put in a spending rule. It meant that we had to put some things in place to make sure that the organisation can keep going and keep operating. That is the Land Rights Network. And it can never go beyond that $485,000. That's mm-hmm. always there. In perpetuity, anyway,
$185 million
that we're, we exist off. So in 2010, 2011, we looked at let's put our hand up to for mining opportunities, and not just to be sitting at the table as possibly someone who might get some benefits from it. We said no longer is it going to be. Accepted that we're just going to be one to accept what's fallen off the table, the scraps, so to speak. We want to own the mines. We want to change the game. And we put our hands up with expressions of interest in particular, gas, which is coal seam gas and natural gas, potential for other mining opportunities that were there. So when there were... opportunities to put in for an expression of interest for those mining licenses, we put our hat in the ring. We had someone come to our table and said, we'd like to partner with you in this. They have the expertise, we don't. And so we've decided that we'd enter into a partnership, and we've started putting in some expression of interest to acquire some of these licenses. It's been a waiting game now for roughly 2 years. We haven't heard anything. We're not quite sure when any information will be provided as to whether we've been successful or not with any of those minings. But, you know, if we try and look into a crystal ball, if we are successful, then all of a sudden the paradigm shift has begun. All of a sudden, we've started getting into the potential of the resources, gaining some benefits from the resources. Now, we know what mining has done for people. It's created a lot of division. It's created a lot of concern. Certainly, there's been a lot, some damage along the way. Some people say it's a lot of damage. But we as a council, we sat around and we said, well, look, we can bury our heads in the sand. We know it's going to happen. We can bury our heads in the sand, or we can take this bold step and put our hand up and say, no, we'd like to be in there. Because if we are going to look after the generation that are to come, and we're looking 30 years, 40 years down the track, we're not talking about just the next 10, 15 years. We're talking about the next 30, 40, 50 years and how we can secure the future for the next generation to look after the Land Rights Act and for those generations. We don't want them to sit there and say, I wish back in the, you know, 20 years ago, these fellows would have done, put in for mining exploration license or looked outside of the square. So we've taken that bold step. We've had a lot of really good positive reaction from our mob. We've had a lot of negative reaction from people outside of the Land Rights Network, and as you can well expect.
That's right, yeah.
People in the Greens movement and stuff. And you know, people saying to us, why is Aboriginal people getting into mining? Why don't you grow veggies and that sort of stuff? I said, oh, my God. Listen to the mentality that yes. still exists today.
Yes.
They don't want Aboriginal people to get ahead. They don't want us to be at the very forefront of driving economics for, not just for ourselves, for our people, but for the state, for the nation.
That's right.
We want to be at the forefront of that, not sitting back and waiting for these fellows to flick us something off the table and say, well, there, dive in and grab your share of the scraps. No longer.
No more being a passenger on the bus. You want to be driving the bus and owning the bus line as well.
Yeah, my word, Tiger, and that's the very thing. And you know what? It didn't start when we were there. It started when the Land Rights Act movement started back in the mid-70s, late 70s, and the Land Rights Act was enacted upon in 83. The vision was there for these fellows to go out and make the most of this piece of legislation. And yes, it gives us the ability to claim land, which then is Torrens title, it's freehold. They can do what with that land, whatever they like. And there are some really great things that are happening from a local land council perspective. They're doing some really terrific stuff with the land that they have. Out west, it's a little bit different. The value of the land isn't quite as significant as it is in the more rural areas or even on the eastern seaboard. But what it offers is other opportunities out there. So we're starting to think outside of the square. We're starting to realise some of the opportunities that are there. And people are now starting to grasp their own sense of self-determination from that thought process.
Yes. Our people are entitled to make these decisions and things, in the best interest of their mob. And I congratulate you on it. I think you don't have to do it the same way. It's a bit like setting up a school, a community-controlled school. We don't have to teach them kids in the same way that the state system is doing. We can do it differently. Mining, same thing, where you're in control of looking after your sites and looking after the country as best as possible, but still get in there and be a part of the resources boom that was taking place. So I congratulate you on it. I think it's a good thing that you've taken the step. Now, with the just recently, you've had a caught you by surprise, I believe, caught New South Wales Land Council by surprise with the announcement by the state government that they were looking at land owned by land councils that happen to include public beaches or beaches. But you just talked about Torrens title, freehold title. So land councils obviously then own some beaches, coastline.
Tiger, there's been two particular cases where land has been granted to a local Aboriginal land council. And the most recent one, which has sort of sparked the response from the Minister for the Lands to introduce that piece of legislation of which brought about the protests or the cultural gathering, as we called it, that took place this week in the streets of the Parliament in Sydney, Macquarie Street. Red Rock was the particular beach. I think it's anywhere between six to 7 miles long. Now, when a claim was put on it, and what we've got to remember in this, and this wasn't certainly let known to other members of the Parliament when it was introduced, that there was great support from the broader community in Coffs Harbour for the local Aboriginal Land Council to put that claim in. They got support from the broader community to say, you should put a claim in on there. And so they did so with the support not just only of the local Aboriginal Land Council members, but of the members of the broader community.
So a claim was placed on vacant Crown land that included beach area?
The beach, yep.
Yeah, right.
Which included the beach area. Mm. And so they put that claim on there. Now, when the presiding judge sat down and made his decision, he said that the Land Council said, well, we don't believe that beach is claimable. He said, no, it's not. He said, but I can grant it to you. And in fact, I will grant it to you, but it comes with a condition. Hmm. And that condition is that there will be an easement to allow for public access at all times. So the land adjoining to the beach and around was granted to the Coffs Harbour Local Aboriginal Land Council with that easement to allow for public access. Hmm. Now, that was granted to them just early this year. I think it might have even been just before Christmas last year.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time that it's been granted to them, the CEO of the Coffs Harbour Local Aboriginal Land Council reliably informs me that there's been something like over 15,000 people, that'll be not just Aboriginal people, not just the members of the local land council, but 15,000 people would have accessed that beach. Now, that just shows that even though it's owned and it's in the title of the Coffs Harbour Local Aboriginal Land Council, through the land rights system, there is the ability that the general public can have access to parts of the land. And it was there. It was a part of the granting of the claim.
Mm.
So when this land was, this bill was introduced into Parliament, and look, we had no prior notice. We had our CEO had a phone call and an email the morning it was being introduced.
Wow.
At the time, he was up in Coffs Harbour. We were actually up in Coffs Harbour attending a local government Shire's election. Shire's conference, which is all of the local government Shires within New South Wales. Not all of them could attend. There's some of those Shires out there that are struggling. they're out there struggling for finances and other reasons. But the phone call and the email came on that particular morning. The bill was introduced and it says that they want to protect the beaches so that it has access. Public beaches have access by the public at all times. We want to prevent it from being owned in inverted commas, and by private, and people cannot have access. Now, the other incident, which is up a little bit further north, also had an easement placed on it where public access was made available. So in the two incidences, when a claim was placed over a beach area, which also included adjoining parts of land, in both instances, the public had access to the land all the time.
Mm.
So there was a bit of misleading information that went in there. There was a bit of fear-mongering because they also mentioned in there we want to make sure that we protect park areas, playground areas, safe life-saving clubs and parks and playground areas and all of these things under what's known as claimable Crown land. Only land that is not used or intended to be used for essential public purposes, anything that falls in that category cannot be claimed.
Mm.
So the system that is available, which is a two system, there's a Crown land system, and under the Aboriginal Land Rights Act, it says this land cannot be claimed. So the system that was there to start with is adequate and sufficient enough to deal with what is or isn't claimable under the Land Rights Act. But there is also the ability to have public access at all times, so it doesn't need to go about with this fear campaign that
exactly.
somehow or other, if a local Aboriginal land council was granted this land, that it's locked away. It's private society. The people that are members of those local Aboriginal land councils, they're not a part of your society. They don't live in the towns that you live in. They don't, you know, participate in all of those activities that other general citizens of your residents of your town do.
Yeah, in the local economy, yeah.
Yes. We're a part of the local economy. We're ratepayers. We live there. We participate in every other thing that takes place in society. But when it suits the government, they want to go out and point us out to say, hello, no, you're private. You are separate from the broader community. And it's an argument that it really does annoy the living daylights out of me. Like we're some private sect that has no access or derives or delivers a benefit to the broader community, that we're somehow separate and that no one else. The only thing that allows that is different with our organisation is to be a part of our organisation, you have to be of Aboriginal descent.
That's right.
That's the only definition that stops everyone else from being a part of it. It's that we have Aboriginal people are the only ones that can be a member of our local Aboriginal land council.
And if the authorities are concerned about conservation of land and land management, who are the supreme conservationists and environmentalists in this country? It can only be First Nations people. I mean, we've got a history. We've got more than 40, 60, 80,000 years of history where we look after country.
And Tiger, within the Act, we have a legislative requirement to both protect and promote the Aboriginal culture. It's stated quite clearly in our Act. We are one of the only organisations in this state, and I don't know whether it happens in other, but it clearly states in our legislation that we have a responsibility, a legislative responsibility, to both protect and to promote the Aboriginal culture and heritage.
Yeah, right. Now, you've organised, on hearing this news and the introduction of the bill in Parliament, you've organised a cultural gathering, as you say, like a protest, where people, quite a number of people, got together down there in Sydney.
Yeah, we did. Look, what the Sydney Newcastle, there was a number of land councils within the one of the nine regions, which is this region being the Sydney Newcastle region. So there was a number of local Aboriginal land councils within that saw this outrageous bill, this discriminatory bill that was also very misleading, and they said, no, we're not going to stand for this. This takes away our very rights and our ability, because some of those beaches have significant sites on it. So they want to make sure that it's protected. But when it's open to the broader public, yeah, there are the ability for people to just drive over, trample over it, and they're damaged and lost forever. And we cannot rely on the OEH or the National Parks to go in there and prosecute these fellows, because they have been doing it for a long time.
That's right.
And there's been little or no action coming from these people to properly prosecute, because once you can determine that you damage something without knowingly damage it, you can get out of jail free,
right?
In a lot of instances, and the penalties are there so punitive that they deliberately do it, because they say, well, if it's only going to cost me $1,400, who cares?
Yes,
big companies can do it. So these guys mobilised themselves together. They said, we're going to have a rally. We're going to go in and have this rally from starting at Hyde Park and going up to Macquarie Street and make our voices heard. This was from a number of land councils right up. So we got wind of it, and the councillor who is the council elect for the Sydney Newcastle region made it known to myself and my fellow councillors that this rally was taking place. We had a meeting last week, myself and my fellow councillors at a constituted meeting of the council, and we said, what's our position on this, councillors? Councillors said, we've endorsed this this gathering, and in fact, we are going to be a part of it. And at no time did we say, well, we're going to now take over, or did we ring these guys. We got in touch with them and said, we endorse it, we want to be a part of it, but we want to walk alongside you guys. You guys are the driving force for this, and we are standing right beside you 100%. And together, Sean Gordon, who was one of the main driving forces from the Darkinjong, Lachlan, Aboriginal, Lancaster, we helped work together with him. He worked with these other local Aboriginal Land Council to make sure that the information was flowing out, that people knew what was happening, where, when, how, why. All of the logistics were nutted out, and we helped to advertise it, and we managed to get, look, I reckon upwards of about 800 people there.
Right.
And this was in a short period of time, Tiger. We had to mobilise ourselves less than, I think it was about 6 days.
Now, as well as that, you also, I see, is also lobbied the likes of Fred Nile. I mean, Fred Nile was there when I was a chairman of the Land Council back in 88, 89, 90. You've lobbied people like this to get them on side as well.
Yeah, very much so. And we did, and it was quite clear to us. We met, we got to thank the likes of Reverend Fred Nile, the likes of Linda Burney and the Labor Party. We've got to thank Jan Barham and the Greens for their support for this. And because they were the ones that they don't have the lower house that the government has the balance of power, but it's in the upper house where the opposition or the crossbenchers have the balance of power. And they made it quite clear that there were two acts sneakily enough going through. One was amendments to the Land Rights Act, because every 5 years we have to do amendments to the Act or look at it, review it, and see if there's anything that needs to be changed in the opportunity. So there was the ALRA amendments bill that, review that was going through, as well as this other bill, which is an amendment to the Crown Lands Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it quite clear that if one, if you don't pull this discriminatory bill, which is the Crown Lands amendment, we will not be supporting the other one. And I hope that some pressure was there. But you're absolutely right, Tiger, when you said Fred Niles was there in 83. He was a staunch supporter. In fact, I think he might be the only member of Parliament that still is around who was a part of that first enactment of the Land Rights Act in 1983.
All right.
And he still is a champion. He still is a champion for what the Land Rights Act was back then and what it delivers today.
You know, it's important to have those allies like Fred and other independents and the Greens in the upper house particularly. Now, as a result of this lobbying and people getting together at local council level, as a result of that, there's been a backflip or a change of heart by the New South Wales government. But it doesn't seem like it's a bit, I don't know, it seems like they could be planning something for further down the track. How do you see it?
Look, I think, you know this as well as anyone, having dealt with them, Tiger. Government are government. You never take your finger off the pulse with them. What they tell you now could change dramatically in a month from a year from now or 18 months from now. So we're going to be very wary of it. We thank the Premier for his leadership in ensuring that this bill was pulled. We thank the Deputy Premier for also his leadership and ensuring that the bill was pulled as well. Despite the way and the nature in which the bill was introduced in the very first instance, we're still willing and ready to get down and sit down and talk with the government about how to improve. Of course, there still is a review of the Crown lands that'll take place. So whether that particular amendment will, sneakily come up in the process, what's still taking place with the Crown lands, we're not sure, but we're certainly very much on our guard. Mm. And we'll be looking for any of those little sneaky insertions in along the way.
Most certainly. Now, you did have Tracker magazine as a great propaganda mechanism where you could inform people, not just in New South Wales, right across the country. And an example of this where you don't have it, and I don't know whether you've got something in place of it, but is it would serve a purpose, Tracker magazine would serve a purpose in something like this. Are there any regrets or any consideration to introduce an alternative to that, or have you already done it? What's the situation?
Yeah, well, look, we council made a decision to discontinue with Tracker. We wanted to go down a new path. We've gone down, so we're sending out e-newsletters every month. There's a Facebook site that also gives regular updates on things like the cultural gathering that took place on Monday. Heaps of photos are on it, terrific photos that were on there, powerful information that people can get on their phone as and when they move. So the younger generation, I saw some of our elders with their phones checking out the stuff that's on there. There's Twitter sites. So we've gone into, the new age of how media is running. And we know for a fact that a lot of the print papers have actually are starting to head towards that online stuff, that e-newsletters and that sort of stuff. So we just made a decision that we wanted to concentrate wholly and solely on the network first and foremost. We wanted to make sure that we tell the good stories that are happening within our local Aboriginal Land Council. And we are absolutely satisfied that what we have now is exactly what our membership was asking for. It's certainly what the vision that the council has had in mind. And we think that we've got it right. It certainly is always going to be a work in progress. And how do we improve our ease newsletter? And basically, it just says our land council, our mob, our future.
Right.
That's what it stands for. Mm-hmm. And my if you would like to have a copy of it, I'm sure our staff at Newswalk would be happy to set up a page where they can send you updates on any issues that are relevant to the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, that you can get your monthly e-newsletter delivered to your email address, or it can come direct to your phone through either your Facebook page or an e-newsletter, which can be directed to your phone as well. So I have the beauty of getting everything, all the updates that that happens with Newswalk that might talk about, the cultural gathering that talks about some of the really good positive stuff. And it's enlightening to see. And there's stories that none of our reporters are writing them.
Yeah.
We're doing little short videos where some of the local members are actually telling their story and what it means for them to be a part of their land care. What drives them to be a part of it? What motivated them to get involved in the first place, and where do they see their land council going? Where do they see their involvement with the local Aboriginal Land Council? And it's their words, not ours. Yeah. We're not scripting anything. It's them talking passionately from their heart and telling the story. So we're very pleased with where we've gone, with the new direction. And most important, we think our membership are very pleased with where we've gone with this new media strategy. All so, right. Tiger, if you guys haven't yet signed up for it, we're happy to accommodate and make sure that you get a copy of our e-newsletter on a regular basis. I'm sure any of your staff that...
Yeah, no, I'll follow you up on that. I'll follow you up on that because our newsroom should also be a recipient of that, be signed up to that, as well as myself here. So I'll follow you up on that. But look, it's congratulations on the pressure that you've brought to bear to bring the government to reconsider their amendment to the Crown Lands Act. And I can, congratulate you, the mob, the people that mobilise and organise on the ground, local councils and Newswork for supporting them. That's probably, I'm getting close to the end of the news.
Right, before we leave, can I just switch the roles around here a little bit? And this is just personally for me. Can I just ask you a question?
Yeah, go on, go ahead.
What was it like in them days, Tiger, when you were at the very forefront? Because I can remember you with this ponytail and, and the hat and stuff, you know, being at the very forefront. And I sat there and I was filled with passion watching, excuse me, yourself and others, you know, making your voice be known and taking the fight up to the parliament and other people. Mm. What was it like for you and what are your memories of it?
I've got very fond memories, particularly as the Newswork chairperson. We had other young people on board like Monica Morgan and Robbie Carroll and young Cruz, young Ben Cruz and Danny Chapman and people, as well as a good balance of older mob on the council. But very fond memories. It was, we had at that time the Premier attacking us severely, wanting to make changes and take away the statutory bodies of the regional councils and local councils. And we fought hard against that. Nick Greiner was the Premier. But we did utilise, as you've done, did the lobbying of the independents in the upper house, because in New South Wales you have the very fortunate situation where you've got an upper house and as you've said, the crossbenchers and some of these independents like Fred Nile can block the government in the upper house. So it's similar in that regard, very similar with the New South Wales government continually attacking. We were always under attack. But as I said earlier, I think it's the greatest piece of legislation in this country that allows for self-determination. You are able to live your sovereignty. You are able to enact. You are self-determining. And local land councils are self-determining. I think that's the great benefit. And to see that continue to take place, I think it's fantastic. But I think the threats, the attacks are still very much the same. We still got to justify and legitimise our struggle and who we are and our identity and our claims to country. I don't think that's changed any. But it's good to see some of you younger fellows. I mean, I think I was 35 when I was elected as chairperson of New South Wales Land Council. So I may have been the youngest chairperson on record there to this day. But younger people coming through is important. And to have that autonomy on the ground with local councils is essential. And I, for one, think that it's probably a better structure. It's a more workable structure. It's a less not such a heavy draw on resources to not have regional councils set up, because there was a lot of resources and a lot of cost going into maintaining the regional councils, whereas to have local councils and deal directly with Newswork, I think, is the way to go. But, does that answer your question?
No, well, look, and certainly, like I said at the very onset, for me, this is an absolute pleasure to sit and talk to one of the legends that I believe that were there. I want to let you know that one of the fellows that you mentioned in there, which is Rob Carroll, he's currently still involved. He's as passionate as all ever, and he's the CEO of his local Aboriginal Land Council there. So the other day we had the likes of Uncle Ozzy Cruz, who was there, and is still as passionate as ever. And you know, there were a lot of the old campaigners there were there, and some of them said, we've been waiting for this. We wanted to march for a long time. So they've been waiting for the reason to just mobilise. And out of it, you know, we got the desired result that we were looking for, Tiger. But for me, I've got to say this, and I'll say this both innocently, but also with a fair amount of absolute pride. That was my very first march that I've ever attended, ever. And I am a sort of a, I don't know, I consider myself a philosophical person. So it's, I looked at what other people gain out of it. And I saw there were the younger ones that were there that were looking around thinking, what's going on here? Mm. But they were marching with some of the elders that had been there before, that had marched many times for their rights to be heard, to be...
That's good to see that opportunity to march.
And there was one particular uncle that I had the opportunity, I sat down with him and I said, Uncle, what was it like for you? He said, you know what? He said, my passion, when ATSIC had been disbanded, he said, my fire was put out.
Across Australia, this is Cassandra Tim with the National Indigenous News. Murray rights campaigners say they left a meeting with the Brisbane City Council this week with smiles on their faces after a unanimous vote to transfer management of the Musgrave Park Cultural Centre to its Indigenous directors. On Tuesday, Sam Watson, with other Indigenous figures, attended a council meeting after directors turned up this week to the centre to find locked gates and all assets missing. Mr. Watson says Lord Mayor Graham Quirk must honour the decision made and transfer full management authority to Indigenous lands.
We came away from that meeting feeling very pleased and feeling that we've achieved something real for our community. We're hanging on here. It's been a gathering place and an important cultural place for our people since time immemorial. So council needs to be aware of this, and council needs to transfer management to the present day. The Brisbane City Council are the management authority. They're the ones who make all the decisions about the use of the hall, about groups needing to access the hall to run a range of activities. But in actual legal fact, this hall is sitting on a lease, a docket lease, a bit of deed of grant and trust, and it's set aside exclusively for Aboriginal cultural purposes. So we would ask the Lord Mayor and his administration to honour the terms and conditions of that lease, and honour the decision that was made in council yesterday and facilitate the handover of full management authority to our Musgrave Park Cultural Centre Incorporated so that we can carry through with our community work.
A prominent community worker and member of South Australia's First Nations community says a greater percentage of taxpayer money should be spent on reducing Indigenous disadvantage. Waka Waka Joe Wilmot is a resident of Adelaide and member of Relationship Australia's Indigenous Network. Ms. Wilmot says with First Nations people among the most disadvantaged in Australia, she questions why so little funding is allocated to programs.
If we have a high number of Aboriginal people incarcerated, a high number of Aboriginal people with ill health, if we have a high number of Aboriginal people on drugs and alcohol, nothing's going to change that without Aboriginal people in total control of their services and not being held by government policies that chop and change and diminish the work that Aboriginal people have to do. We go cap in hand asking for some semblance of humanity from an inhumane government.
A First Nations rights advocate says he disagrees with Professor Marcia Langton's recent comments that there is a dire methamphetamine issue in Indigenous communities. Western Cape York traditional owner, One Year Man Jack Wilkie Jans, says he believes the prevalence of the drug ICE in remote communities is no greater than in the big cities. He says there should be more discussion about drug rehabilitation.
I think if there's any other discussion regarding ICE, it should be directly in regards to rehabilitation centres or health services, making sure that that is as good as it can be for those communities in regards to any drug, including alcohol and tobacco. I think that this is just the ICE is an excuse to push forward some agenda for welfare reform.
We'll have sport and weather straight after this.
Have you always wanted to study but didn't think you could? The Australian Centre for Indigenous Knowledges and Education offers a pathway into uni. Our free Preparation for Tertiary Success program is offered in Darwin and Alice Springs with small, short workshops with other Indigenous students from around Australia. Financial assistance is available for travel and accommodation costs. To find out more, call 1800 061 963 or go to acike.edu.au/PTS.
Program sponsor.
Sport Now with Sean Bindley.
With calls from animal rights activists for a tightening of rules and a ban on whipping becoming increasingly insistent, the results of the autopsy into the death of Melbourne Cup favourite Admire Racti indicate that the horse died of a heart attack. The pre-race favourite, the winner of the Caulfield Cup a fortnight ago, was well on the hunt in the Cup before fading with a kilometre to go. In the face of demands for greater scrutiny, VRC Chief Steward Terry Bailey denied that there was a problem with the horse before the race.
These horses are overlooked by vets every day, and the horse was even examined again on race morning by our vets and trotted up fine and fit as a fiddle.
And that's the latest in news and sport. Now,
serving the best country 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The only place to be is right here on 98.9 FM for the best country.
This town, and I can't hold out
to believe in. Paul Green with When You Move in Walls by Tom Petty, and Victoria Avenue with Knock Knock. I want to say good morning. This is the Hot Country Show. My name is Bo Spearham, and I'm with you guys for the next few hours. Before I go any further, I'd like to say Yama. Yama, I come from, means welcome. I come from the Gimilaray Nation of Northern New South Wales and the Southern Queensland. I also have bloodline connections to the Kuma and the